The idea of hosting an angel unawares is kind of a fantastical and cool idea. In fact, this idea is such an interesting idea, it's often a trope in a lot of movies and literature and TV shows where a family or a person takes in some person off the street and it turns out they have some supernatural powers or they're from God with some message. And if you're like me, when you look at verses like Hebrews 13:2, it can be easy to get lost in the speculation and ideas and imagination and kind of miss the practical point. The practical point is, be diligent to show hospitality. And the nice thing is, in Genesis 18, we have a story about Abraham and Sarah hosting angels unawares. And as a fantastical and incredible account this is, it's also very practically applicable. There's a lot of lessons we can learn from this chapter and apply to our life. If we have time, there's three basic things I want to look at. First, I want to look at Abraham's example of hospitality. He's an excellent example of hospitality. And even though we shouldn't expect God to show up on our doorstep, there's a lot of ways we can apply what Abraham does when we show hospitality to strangers. Second, when Abraham and Sarah bring God and these angels into their house, a lot of unexpected things happen. And once again, even though I don't think God in person shows up in our houses very often, there's a lot of parallels that we can apply to our life from when you do bring strangers in your house. Sometimes unexpected things happen that can lead to a lot of growth. And if we have time, there's also some lessons we can learn about prayer. So let's start in Genesis chapter 18, verses 1 through 8. Genesis 18, 1 through 8. And the Lord appeared to him by the oaks of Mamre. This is right after God has given Abraham the covenant circumcision, by the way. As he, that being Abraham, sat at the door of his tent in the heat of the day, he lifted up his eyes and looked, and behold, three men were standing in front of him. When he saw them, he ran from the tent door to meet them and bowed himself to the earth and said, O Lord, if I have found favor in your sight, do not pass by your servant. Let a little water be brought, and wash your feet, and rest yourselves under the tree. While I bring a morsel of bread, that you may refresh yourselves, and after that you may pass on, since you have come to your servant. So they said, Do as you have said. And Abraham went quickly into the tent and said, into the tent to Sarah and said, Quick, three seahs of fine flour, knead it and make cakes. And Abraham ran to the herd and took a calf, tender and good, and gave it to a young man who prepared it quickly. Then he took curds and milk and the calf he had prepared and sat it before them. And he stood by them under the tree while they ate. So I said mistakenly, we shouldn't expect God to come before us in person. And it is true. I don't think God's angel comes down and sees us. But as I was saying that, I remembered Matthew chapter 25 when Jesus judges between the sheep and the goats. And remember what he tells them? Whatever you did for the least of these, or didn't do for the least of these, you did for me. So actually, yes, God appears to us through other people. So I want to correct myself there. So anyway, God literally does appear in person to Abraham, but he doesn't know it. But you almost can't tell he doesn't know it because of the respect and the urgency he practices hospitality. Like, you almost have to read it for a while to kind of tell that he doesn't know what's going on. But anyway, notice the urgency in the initiative Abraham practices. When God appears at the oaks of Mamre, in verse 2, as soon as Abraham sees them, he's kind of like, I imagine him almost like a sprinter. You ever watch a track race? And you know how the sprinters get up, and as soon as the gun goes, pshw, that's how I kind of view him. He's probably taking an afternoon nap. He gazes up, and there are some strangers in the heat of the day, and boom, he's there ready to help them. That's how hospitable he is. It's almost like a race. And speaking of race, he's running in this. He's running to Sarah, quickly, do this. He says to the boy, here, take this. And the boy does it quickly. So there's a lot of urgency. He's taking this very seriously. And I think the first thing I want to see from this is sometimes in order to be a good host and to be hospitable, you have to be the one to take initiative. Oftentimes, I know in my life, I've just kind of sat and waited for people to come to me. Like, man, I haven't had anybody over because nobody's invited themselves over. Well, you know what the problem with that thinking is? Most people aren't going to do that. A lot of good people don't want to be a bother. They don't want to be an inconvenience. They don't want to put somebody out. They don't want to be trouble. So we just keep our needs to ourselves and we don't ask for help. And, you know, I will say people do need to take initiative and ask for help more. I'm not saying that. But are we going to condemn God for not being the one to initiate this? Is God wrong for waiting for Abraham to initiate? Clearly not. Abraham's doing the right thing. He sees somebody who he could help, and he helps him. That's a good example of hospitality. Also, notice the time of day this happens. This isn't in the morning when the day is cool. This isn't when the sun is going down. This is in the heat of the day. Now, I don't know what time of year this was or where in the land of Canaan they are, but it's probably hot no matter what time of year and what time of year or what area he's in. Most likely, it's probably hot. It's in the heat of the day. This is where most people are trying to take it easy, get some rest, or even take your afternoon nap. And what's Abraham doing? He's running around, working really hard, a 99-year-old man at this point, making sure his guests are taken care of. We talk about sometimes where Paul writes about we need to put the needs of others before ourselves. In Philippians chapter 2, verse 3, Paul writes, "Do nothing from selfish ambition or conceit, but in humility count others more significant than yourselves." That's what Abraham is doing here. He's forgoing his afternoon nap. He's forgoing the time of rest. And he's going out of his way in a time that's really inconvenient to make sure his guests are well taken care of. That's an example, just one example, of putting the needs of others before yourself. Something else I think it's interesting about Abraham, notice how he invites the people over, for lack of a better term. In verse 3, does he say, "Oh, nice to see you. Stop by any time." Is that what he says? I think sometimes that's the extent of our hospitality. Oh, yeah, whenever you feel like it, invite yourself over. We kind of like put it on them to take initiative, kind of like what I was saying before. But he pleads, like literally pleads with them. He's bowing on the ground. He's calling them Lord and he his their servant. And he's imploring them. He says, "Oh, Lord, if I found favor in your sight." He's making it seem like he's asking a favor. That's how much he wants to show hospitality. You know, often I can kind of make myself feel better by saying, "Oh yeah, I said they can come over anytime." Then I feel like I've been hospitable. Abraham puts a little bit more effort than that. He's literally begging to help them. And once again, I think we fall short of this example all the time. We want people to do the uncomfortable thing and expose themselves and embarrass themselves and ask for help. Once again, we need to do that more, yes. But you know, sometimes people in need of help aren't always going to be willing to do that. And if we truly are the stronger person, then maybe we should implore at least a little bit to help them. Like, is Abraham wrong for doing this? This is kind of a biblical example of being a little bit pushy. Just a little bit. Something else that I think is very remarkable from this example of hospitality is how he under-promises and over-delivers. This was something that actually Kevin Biesecker had told me a couple years ago. Like, one reason why we're afraid to show hospitality is we don't feel like we can offer people a 5-star experience. And you know I can't. You're lucky if you're getting like 0.5-star with me. But if that's the case, that's what you offer. Like, he doesn't offer them what he actually gives them. He just offers them the bare minimum. He says, in verse 5, or verse 4, a little bit of water to wash your feet, and in verse 5, a morsel of bread. He promises them just a very little. But then what does he do? When he has the ability to do more, he does more. He has five cakes made, so he's not just offering them more. He's not going to just give them a morsel of bread. He's going to give them a whole big old thing of bread, multiples. Then he has a calf slaughtered. Like, it's like he's preparing a feast. Having the young calf killed, that's what the father, the prodigal son, does when his son returns. He is really treating them special. He's literally practicing hospitality. The word hospitality literally means the love of strangers. You know, if I went to visit somebody and they slaughtered the young calf for me, I'm surely going to feel loved. I'll tell you that much. But literally, they would have felt the same way too if these weren't angels and the Lord himself. I imagine the Lord appreciated it. But he under-promises and over-delivers. But I want to be clear. I'm not saying that you intentionally tell people they're only going to get a little bit and kind of trick them and offer them more. I'm saying set healthy expectations. You know, if all you have is a little bit of water and a morsel of bread, and that's all you can give, that's also very loving too. Think about the woman in the temple who only had half a penny to give. Jesus praised her. So I'm not trying to say, like, do it like a social manipulation, but set expectations low. If all you know is you want to stay the night? Well, you can have my couch. And you happen to also find yourself with a bed? Well, then let them have the bed when they show up. But don't offer them more than what you can deliver. And also, don't set expectations for yourself that are too high. Sometimes we feel like we need to offer a five-star experience every time, when sometimes all people need is a little bread and water. That's all they need. So it's a really helpful example, not just setting expectations for others, but also for ourselves. But the fact that he does go out of his way, not just in what he gives them, but also in the end of verse 8, notice at the end of verse 8, he says, "Then he took curds and milk and the calf that he prepared and set it before them, and he stood by them under the tree while they ate." He doesn't just serve them and give them things. He spends time with them and he attends to their needs. A remarkable thing about Job that I always hammer whenever I'm teaching Job is in Job 31, Job makes clear that not only did he provide for the orphans, he ate with them too. He shared his morsel with them. I think sometimes we limit hospitality to just providing room, board, and some food. Well, I think the most important part of hospitality is probably the human interaction that goes with it. Like, as much as I really like tasty food, I would much rather have a dinner of herbs with friends than a nice steak by myself, usually, unless I'm tired of being with people, which is sometimes the case. But you know, there's actually a proverb that talks about that, actually. So, and a very important part of hospitality is actually loving the stranger, being with them. And this isn't talking about hospitality in particular, but in John 13, verse 35, Jesus says, "By this they shall know that you are my disciples, by your love for one another." Now, once again, that's talking about love between us, but I think that same principle can apply to when we're working with strangers. When we go out of our way to serve people, when we take the needs of others and put them as more significant than ourselves, that shows that we're different. Some of the times where I've gotten connections with Christians who are struggling, and I've gotten connections with people in the community, is when I practice hospitality. A lot of Bible studies started with a meal, either at some restaurant or at the table, by having people over and getting to know them. I mean, think about it. How can you know what somebody needs to hear if you don't ever know them? Like, what are we supposed to do? Just guess and be judgmental people and assume we know what they need? I guarantee you, that doesn't work. I've tried it way too often. It doesn't work. You have to spend time with them. And if they don't know you care about them, they don't care about what you know. So this is just a super helpful example of practicing good hospitality. And these are things that we can all practice and apply to our own lives. But you know, I think there's something else besides the practical things that hold us back from hospitality, and it is actually the fear of the human interactions that will happen. See, we like imagining all the cool things that'll happen if we have an angel unawares, but in verses 9 through 15, you know what happens when Abraham and Sarah host angels unawares? Sarah's going to get pretty embarrassed. Like, it's not as fun as you think it is. It's actually kind of sobering when it actually did happen. Read verse 9 with me. They said to him, that being the angels to Abraham, "Where is Sarah, your wife?" And he said, "She is in the tent." The Lord said, "I will surely return to you about this time next year, and Sarah, your wife, shall have a son." And Sarah was listening at the tent door behind him. Now Abraham and Sarah were old, advanced in years. The way of woman had ceased to be with Sarah. So Sarah laughed to herself, saying, "After I am worn out and my Lord is old, shall I have pleasure?" The Lord said to Abraham, "Why did Sarah laugh and say, 'Shall I indeed bear a child, and now I'm old? Is anything too hard for the Lord? At the appointed time, I will return to you about this time next year, and Sarah shall have a son.'" But Sarah denied it, saying, "I did not laugh," for she was afraid. He said, I think that being God, "No, but you did laugh." So in the text, while Abraham is serving the Lord and his angels, God asks about Sarah, not because he didn't know where she was, but I guess to kind of keep the guys going on. Abraham tells the Lord where Sarah is, and then God, knowing where Sarah is and that she can hear him, proceeds to tell Abraham and Sarah what's going to happen. They're going to have a child. Now, this isn't the first time God has told Abraham that he's going to have a child. In fact, it's not the second time. In chapter 17, God has promised Abraham that him and Sarah shall have a child. And then earlier, in chapter 15, God implies that he's going to have a nation, which would necessitate having a child, which is why they try to go through Hagar. So this is not new information to them, but there's a finality given. God says, about this time next year, you will have a child. It's kind of easy to listen to something when it's vague and uncertain and undefined. Like, oh yeah, sure, that'll happen. But now the stranger is saying, "I'll be back here in a year and then you'll have a kid." That's a lot more real and a lot more definite. And what's Sarah's response? Understandably, she laughs. I mean, in a human point of thinking, I don't know how old she was at this time. Abraham's 99 years old plus. It is kind of funny. If you talk to two really old people and said, "You're going to have a child in a year," I think they would all probably laugh or be offended, one of the two. I think this is kind of evidence they didn't know this was God personally. But anyway, so he tells them something they probably weren't ever expecting, at least not in this way. Maybe God would speak to them in a different way and they would have taken it better. But from people who they might not have known were God telling them this, they react in a way that's unusual. They react in a way because it's unusual. And here's the funny thing. God knows she laughed. I don't know if he literally heard her or if it's just his foreknowledge or infinite wisdom. Either way, she knows she laughs. God knows she laughs. And how does she respond when God points out her laughing? She denies it. She denies the obvious truth. You know, Sarah not only learned she's going to have a son in a year, she also learned that she lies when she's afraid. You know, maybe that's why her and Abraham get along, because he does that too. But her interaction with God has just revealed a pretty nasty blind spot in her life. And you know, I think it's interactions like these that we're so afraid to practice hospitality to strangers. Because when you bring people who are different than you in your house, with different perspectives, and you have no idea what you're going to say to them, what they're going to say to you, that in of itself is scary. But also, we tend to like to surround people around us who have the same blind spots as us, or at least sensitive to our blind spots. And the idea of iron sharpening iron, that's kind of scary. So, you know, a good way to stop iron from sharpening iron? You don't ever let them touch. Don't ever let them get close. You can't sharpen a chisel that never touches the grinding wheel. So I think sometimes we're afraid of getting new people in our lives because they might challenge us in ways we've never been challenged before. I think what happens with God and Sarah in a lot of ways is miraculous, but in a lot of ways it's entirely human. When I gain new people in my life, maybe this is just a me problem, there's often new problems I learn about in my life. Because the people around me probably just get sick and tired of telling me things, so they give up. But when you get somebody new, you start hearing new things. Mike talked about having blind spots. And everybody has blind spots. And if you get enough people together, you get a good 360 view, and it's kind of hard to start hiding your blind spots. So I think we don't want to be like Sarah. But think about it. Was this interaction that Sarah had with God good or bad? Yes, it was embarrassing. I get that. But was this interaction that she had with the Lord good or bad? Good. She learned about what God's plans were for her life. She learned some new information. And also, she might have learned some new things about herself in areas she can grow. Isn't that pretty good? It's not fun. Kind of scary. Like, having somebody in my house and then them telling me all the ways I need to change, that's kind of scary. Not very polite either. But it's good. That is good for us. So then, after this happens, then we see, I think, God revealing himself in an example of a friend of God talking with God and God talking with his friend. We're kind of leaving hospitality and talking about prayer. In verse 16, it says, "Then the men went out from there, and they looked down toward Sodom, and Abraham went with them to set them on their way. The Lord said, 'Shall I hide from Abraham what I'm about to do, seeing that Abraham shall surely become a great and mighty nation, and all the nations of the earth shall be blessed in him. For I have chosen him, that he may command his children and his household after him, to keep the way of the Lord by doing righteousness and justice, so that the Lord may bring to Abraham what he has promised him.' Then the Lord said, 'Because the outcry against Sodom and Gomorrah is great, and their sin is very grave, I will go down to see whether they have done altogether according to the outcry that has come to me. And if not, I will know.'" So it's kind of hard in some ways to apply what we see here to our lives. God has a very special prophetic relationship with God. God speaks to him directly, and he's telling him of the future. But actually, in some ways, I think Jesus promises not this exact thing, but Jesus promises that he will reveal what God's plans are to his friends. This is entirely within God's character. In John chapter 15, 14 and 15, Jesus says, "You are my friends if you do what I command you. No longer do I call you servants, for the servant does not know what his master is doing. But I have called you friends, for all that I have heard from my Father I have made known to you." So, you know what Jesus does for his friends? You know what God is doing for his friend Abraham here? He's revealing God's will. Now, I think specifically, the primary way God does that for us is through his word. I think that's the primary way God does that. And when we live a life that where we strive to obey God, that's helpful for us understanding God's word. In Titus chapter 1, verse 15, Paul writes, "To the pure, all things are pure. But to the defiled and unbelieving, nothing is pure. But both their minds and their consciences are defiled." The type of heart we have and the type of life we live helps us understand the world. I think it was Psalm 18 Dan was reading from this morning. The type of person we are is largely the type of person we are determines largely how we view God. So it determines how we view the world, it determines how we view God, and it determines whether or not we're willing to understand God's word. When the disciples asked Jesus, why does he speak in parables? In Matthew chapter 13, he talks about it so that only those with ears to hear will hear. Only those with good hearts. So I don't think God's going to come up to me and tell me who's going to win the Super Bowl, who's going to win the election, or who's going to do whatever else I want to know. But I think the idea of God revealing his will to his friends still holds true today. It's not as dramatic as it is with Abraham, but if we have a heart that strives to serve God, we will learn his will, especially the will that's been revealed in his word. So anyway, God does that for Abraham, and it's really personal. I really like the way in verse 17, God says, "Shall I hide from Abraham what I'm about to do?" I don't know about you guys, but I've had conversations with myself. I've spent some, especially when I'm spending time with people I don't see a lot and they're really close or people I value, I'm a pretty private person usually, and there's almost always a time where I think to myself, well, am I going to hold back what's going on in my life, or am I going to share it with these people? After all, they are very important to me than I normally do, usually. Not always, but usually. I kind of sympathize with what God's saying here. He's reasoning with himself. Abraham's my friend, so of course I should tell him. And so he tells him. He tells Abraham that he's going to go and destroy Sodom. Well, that's a pretty important piece of information to Abraham, because guess who's living in Sodom right now? His nephew Lot. It's a really considerate thing God told him that. And you know one reason why we don't normally open up to our friends? It's because we don't want to talk about what we're opening up about. I think maybe that's part of the thing going on in the Lord's head. He knows if he talks to Abraham about it, Abraham's going to want to talk about it, which he will. But once again, that shows God's propensity to have these conversations and to have this intimate relationship. It reminds me of 1 Peter 5:7, where Peter tells us to cast our cares on Jesus because he cares for us. He actually does want to hear what Abraham has to say. So in verse 22, "So the men turned from there and went toward Sodom, but Abraham still stood before the Lord. Then Abraham drew near and said, 'Will you indeed sweep away the righteous with the wicked? Suppose there are 50 righteous within the city. Will you then sweep away the place and not spare it for the 50 righteous who are in it? Far be it from you to do such a thing, to put the righteous to death with the wicked, so that the righteous fare as the wicked. Far be that from you. Shall not the judge of the earth do what is just?' And the Lord said, 'If I find at Sodom 50 righteous in the city, I will spare the whole place for their sake.'" Notice the boldness Abraham has when he asks God about this. He asks him twice. Is it really right for the judge of the earth to do this? And then he says, "Far be it from you." Like, come on, Lord, you know better than that. I think he said it more respectfully than that, as we'll see. But he's bold. He's confident in his relationship with God. Continuing on, "Abraham answered and said, 'Behold, I have undertaken to speak to the Lord. Who am I but dust and ashes? Suppose 5 of the 50 righteous are lacking. Will you destroy the whole city for lack of 5? God says, "I will not destroy it if I find 45 there." Again he spoke to him and said, "Suppose 40 are found there." He answered, "For the sake of 40, I will not do it." Then he said, Oh, let not the Lord be angry, and I will speak. Suppose 30 are found there." He answered, "I will not if I find 30 there." We'll stop there for a moment. So he's bold. Like, if you remember what he said earlier, he's quite bold in saying, "God, this doesn't make sense for you to destroy the righteous with the wicked." But he's also extremely humble. As he says, God's the judge of the earth. And if God's the judge of the earth, what does that make Abraham? Someone who's liable to judgment. So when he's speaking to the judge of the earth, he's bold, but he also remembers his place. Proverbs chapter 1, verse 7 says, "The fear of the Lord is the beginning of knowledge." Abraham wouldn't have the relationship he had with God if he didn't have a fear of God. And you see him practicing that fear of God in the way he speaks to God. You know, Abraham doesn't get rebuked for the way he speaks to God here. In fact, well, we'll get there when we get there, but God does even more than what Abraham asks. And I think it's interesting, when you look at Abraham and his prayer and Job and how he challenges God, I wonder if the difference is, even though they both challenge God, Abraham understood that God was the judge, and he spoke to God with fear of judgment. Job understood God was judge, and he wanted to take him to court. I wonder if that's why Job gets rebuked, but Abraham doesn't. I don't know, but it's just a thought I have in mind. So anyway, he speaks to God boldly, he practices humility, he asks God for mercy just to say a few more words to him. And then every time God gives him an answer, it's almost like a little child when they're asking mom for something or dad for something, and like they realize, maybe I should have asked for more. And he says, what about missing 5? What about missing 10? And he keeps on whittling his way down. In verse 31, he says, behold, I have undertaken to speak to the Lord. Suppose 20 are found there. He answered, for the sake of 20, I will not destroy it. Then he said, oh, let the Lord not be angry, and I will speak again, but this once. Suppose 10 are found there. He answered, for the sake of 10, I will not destroy it. And the Lord went on his way when he had finished speaking to Abraham, and Abraham returned to his place. And then we know the rest of the story. In Genesis 19, the two angels that God sent are going to rescue Lot, and kind of rescue Lot's family. Not because the angels don't rescue them, it's only because Lot's family and Lot himself give them a lot of trouble. But I think it's really interesting how God and Abraham handled the end of this prayer. So Abraham finishes asking God, and then he says, this is my last request. He makes it his last request. And then what does he do after God leaves? Does he like follow to make sure God's going to do what he wants? No, he goes back home. I think that's demonstrating a confidence in God. I don't need to watch God and micromanage him. I trust that my request has been heard, and I'm just going to wait. Now, you know what else is really interesting about this prayer? Does God agree to the terms of Abraham's request? Yeah, he does. Everything Abraham asks, God says, sure, I won't do that. But does God still destroy the city? So he says yes to Abraham's prayer. He doesn't spare the city, but he ultimately gives Abraham what he really wanted, the life of Lot. I'd imagine that's why Abraham was asking. He was asking on behalf of his nephew Lot. Doesn't say that, but I think that's a safe assumption. So God said yes to Abraham's prayer, didn't give him what he literally asked for, but gave him what he really wanted. It's kind of an interesting concept when you think about it. And it's kind of somehow how prayer works. We might ask God for something, and he might be willing to give it to us, but he has something better in mind. We often ask, God, why aren't you giving me what I wanted? Well, it's often because God has something better in planned. And we see that here with Abraham. Maybe that's why Abraham trusted God. God has delivered him so often, he knows one way or another, God's going to come through. So that's Genesis chapter 18. I think it's a really, really cool chapter where even though a lot of it is quite dramatic and fantastic, it's still practical. Abraham is a really good example of hospitality. I mean, I gave you guys a few practical examples, but I'm sure if all of you went back and looked at this yourself, you'd find even more ways Abraham excelled. We look at how strangers can change our life, and then we also saw God hears us when we pray. So if you're wanting to grow in hospitality, let God's answer to Abraham's prayer be an encouragement to you. He can help you grow. And if there's any way that we can help you here, please come forward while we sing the song of invitation.